AC360 did not air on CNN today. For this podcast episode, we are bringing you an hour of CNN coverage from earlier in the day.
This is CNN Breaking News.
Welcome back. You're watching a special edition of CNN Newsroom here on this Thanksgiving Day. I'm Brooke Baldwin. Thank you for spending part of your holiday with me. Let's get straight to the big story. The breaking news just this afternoon that the president has made a surprise visit to U.S. troops stationed in Afghanistan. This is the first time he has traveled to this particular country where America has been at war for 18 years. The commander-in-chief said that he has restarted talks with the Taliban and is waiting to see if the Taliban, quote, wants to make a deal with the United States. He also said that a number of troops are coming home from this part of the world without specifying a number. Here he was.
Weeks ago, we also announced that the forces are coming back. They're coming back home. We're reducing over here, but because of technology and all of the things that we have, we're able to reduce in Afghanistan, very substantially actually reduce, and do even more devastating attacks on the enemy.
With me now, CNN White House correspondent Caitlin Collins down there in Florida. And so, Caitlin, let's talk specifically about what he discussed with regard to the Taliban. What did he say?
Well, the president actually made some news while he was in Afghanistan. He talked about how he says they restarted peace talks with the Taliban, something that just 3 months ago he declared dead. But today he announced that those talks are back on.
The Taliban wants to make a deal. We'll see if they want to make a deal. It's got to be a real deal, but we'll see. But they want to make a deal. And they only want to make a deal because you're doing a great job. That's the only reason they want to make a deal. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank the Afghan soldiers.
Now, Brooke, you'll remember it was just less than 3 months ago that the president said the peace talks with the Taliban leaders were dead. That was after he announced on Twitter that he had invited leaders of the Taliban to come to Camp David for those final rounds of negotiations, but said he later called them off after an attack by the Taliban left one person dead. And the president essentially hinting there that he thinks the Taliban is more eager to come to the table this time, though there are going to be questions about a ceasefire and what those talks would look like going forward. But Brooke, just to give you a sense of just how secret the White House kept this trip, the president left Palm Beach last night. He flew to Washington, where he boarded another plane at that airport outside of Washington, and a plane that was not out on the tarmac like it normally is when the president gets on and there are cameras there. Instead, he went into a hangar and boarded the plane inside of that where it was hidden, and that's when they went to Afghanistan. And as they flew there, they had the lights off, the window shades were drawn. And to keep it a secret and to keep suspicions at bay, they even went as far as to schedule tweets to come from the president's Twitter account so that when he didn't have access to the internet and tweets weren't coming from his account, people would not grow suspicious about what was going on with the president's schedule.
Wow. How about that? All the planning, the choreography that goes into a surprise visit like this. Yeah, they pulled it off. Caitlin Collins, thank you in Florida. As we talk about the president at Bagram Air Base today, just north of Kabul, you know, it's important to just recognize the backdrop to this trip. This is the first time that President Trump has addressed members of the military since he intervened in the case of Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher and his colleagues who were accused of war crimes. And the first time since the firing of Navy Secretary Richard Spencer, who just wrote this scorching op-ed in The Washington Post. So let's have a bigger conversation with me now, CNN Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr and CNN military and diplomatic analyst Rear Admiral John Kirby, who also served as the press secretary for the U.S. Navy and the Pentagon. So welcome to both of you. Happy Thanksgiving. And Barbara, we know that the president made that surprise trip to Iraq last Christmas. But let me just start with each of you, beginning with you, Barbara, on the significance of today's trip.
Well, look, the troops always want to see a president of the United States. I think it's something that over the decades, the American people have come quite rightly to expect that the commander in chief, if he is going to send troops into harm's way, hopefully someday it'll be a she that sends that has that responsibility. But if a president is going to send troops into harm's way as commander in chief, they need to demonstrate that they are willing and able to go visit them. It's always a security nightmare. The Secret Service, the U.S. military goes to extraordinary lengths to protect any president of the United States when they travel, especially when they travel to a war zone. A very important signal to military families that this president, any president, is willing to come visit their troops overseas, especially on holidays. Mr. Trump, talking about a Taliban ceasefire, families may get very excited about that. That still may be a very long road ahead. Talking to the Taliban about a ceasefire is not the same as the Taliban agreeing to it and the Taliban agreeing to keep that promise. Still very tough going in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Tough road ahead before he can bring additional troops home. Brooke?
Admiral Kirby, to you, you know, listening to the bigger message from the president, obviously he's there for the troops, had some turkey, as he talked about, you know, also talked about how he, you know, cares so much about the military, talked about the, you know, fancy planes and helicopters that he was helping provide DOD at the same time, you know, boasting about the economy back home. You listened to him. Well, what did you take away from his message today?
Well, first, Brooke, I was really glad to see him go there for all the reasons that Barbara rightly stated. It is important for the commander-in-chief to visit troops in the field over the holidays like that, and it's a great shot in the arm to them. So hats off to him for going. And frankly, I was actually pleased that his talk wasn't more political. Typically, when we've seen him do these phone calls or go in front of troops, it's much more like a political rally, much more energetic. He's lambasting his rivals and critics. He didn't do that today. So I was grateful for that. That said, I think the Afghan could be forgiven for maybe being a little bit uncomfortable with what he said about pulling our troops out and all this readiness to talk to the Taliban. It's important that they be a part of this. And that they are included in whatever talks going forward. Barbara's right. It's going to take a long time. We're not there yet. And if the Taliban smell weakness, which they would if we're just going to precipitously withdraw, it's going to make those talks a lot harder. Now, as for the economy, the troops don't really, that's not their purview. I think that was probably inappropriate for him to bring up. He had to brag. It's just the way he is. But at least he didn't get, as I saw, didn't get all that political. Mm.
There are layers to this, too, Barbara. We talk about the context of this trip. You know, you have all this great reporting today about some concerns that military officials have about the commander-in-chief's recent decision-making. Tell us about those concerns.
Well, let's just again start with a point. The military reflects American society. Absolutely. There are a significant number of military troops that are supporters of this president. Yet that would be expected. That would be the right thing. People in America have a wide variety of political views, and the military reflects that. So that's actually a good thing, I would say. There are some that do not support him. But the difference this time is top commanders are dismayed and concerned, and it's all been building for quite a while. His discussions about, for example, keeping the oil in Syria. That's not something that U.S. military troops do. They don't keep the natural resources. They enable other forces in a country overseas to stand on their own and support a government overseas. They don't do it themselves. They don't keep the oil. His discussions about exonerating these cases involving war crimes allegations, quite dismaying to top commanders. They want a uniform set of rules. They want to be able to administer military justice. And they want to show the troops that there is a system of accountability, that you can't just get the ear of Fox News, which factually is what happened in these cases, and have Fox News factually, which is what happened, get the president's ear and encourage him to exonerate these people. That's really a poor outcome. That's something that has top commanders very worried. They don't want to see this kind of military justice being administered by the president.
It's been a huge story, especially in the last week. And Admiral Kirby, I can't help but think, you know, on this Thanksgiving, when some of us get to be surrounded by our loved ones, you know, you think of the men and women in uniform. I'm sure you had many a Thanksgiving away from home, right, where they're breaking bread with fellow sailors and airmen and soldiers. And they have to be paying attention to what's going on back here, you know, the tensions between the Pentagon and the president. And I'm wondering just do they feel like this country has their back?
Oh, I believe they do. Sure, Brooke. Look, I mean, they're not cut off from the world. They can follow the news. And as Barbara said, some of them have, you know, different opposing views here about their commander-in-chief from a political perspective. But they're focused on the mission. And when you're overseas, particularly at the holidays, and you're right, I have spent several holidays away, That's your second family. That's the family that you're breaking bread with. That's the those are the men and women that you're serving with and that matter to you, and you love them in your own way. And so you're focused on making sure that they're safe, the mission is accomplished, and that your head is screwed on right, and you're not being distracted by what's going on back home. So I'm not worried about them overseas in terms of, you know, all the turmoil here. I think they know what the nation expects of them, and I think more importantly, Brooke, I think they know that the American people are behind them 100%, no matter what political party they're from.
Yes, yes, yes. Admiral Kirby, thank you. Barbara Starr, thank you. And again, happy holiday to both of you. Coming up next, Rudy Giuliani's rough week. We will break down four key developments this week for the president's personal attorney. Also ahead, Michael Bloomberg's campaign manager is arguing that impeachment is actually making it more likely that this president will be reelected. We'll hear him out. And later, protesters in Hong Kong waving U.S. flags after President Trump signed a bill supporting their fight for democracy. But guess what? The Chinese government is none too pleased about that. We are back. You're watching CNN on this Thanksgiving Thursday. This week, the legal walls seem to be really closing in on the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, after weeks of hearing American diplomats testify about how he is, quote unquote, a problem in the impeachment inquiry. There were even more headlines about how his work in Ukraine and elsewhere may have crossed a line. Just to bring it all together, let's go to CNN political correspondent Sarah Murray. And so, Sarah, it's been a bit of a week for Rudy Giuliani.
Not a great week, Brooke, to be Rudy Giuliani. The hits, they just keep piling up this week. I mean, let's start with his own business. We know from our own reporting that prosecutors have been looking into Rudy Giuliani's business dealings. Obviously, not a great thing. And we learned a lot more from reporting from the Washington Post and New York Times about some of those business dealings. We learned that Giuliani, while he was pushing the president's agenda in Ukraine, you know, with Ukrainian officials who really wanted to make nice with the U.S., he was also pursuing business deals in Ukraine, even though he has denied that he ever had any business to do with that country. There are some other questionable business deals. These ones were reported by the Washington Post. This is one where Rudy Giuliani represented a Venezuelan energy executive who's been accused, allegedly, of money laundering and of bribery. Now, while Rudy Giuliani was representing this gentleman, he decided to make the case with other lawyers to the Justice Department that they should not bring criminal charges, which is obviously an interesting position for the president's personal lawyer to be in. And last but not least, there is the awkward relationship between President Trump and Rudy Giuliani. The president was asked in an interview, what was Rudy Giuliani doing on your behalf in Ukraine anyway? And the president said, oh, you have to ask Rudy.
Go talk
to
Rudy.
I don't even know. Yeah. Even though, of course, on the phone call with the Ukrainian president, Donald Trump was the one who said, well, you should talk to Rudy.
Mm-hmm.
Not a
as
great
we,
week.
As we pointed out, kind of sounds like, go talk to Michael Cohen. And well,
all of a sudden, he just has no idea what's going on. Yeah. Strange how that works.
Sarah Murray, happy Thanksgiving, friend.
Thank you.
Let's analyze what Sarah just reported out of the week of Rudy Giuliani. Harry Littman is back with us today. Once served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General, former U.S. Attorney, and with us now. So, Harry, happy Turkey Day to you.
Hi, Brooke. Happy Thanksgiving.
From what we know, where does Giuliani have the most legal exposure?
Well, it's sort of two big pots of legal exposure because he was doing two different things. He, on the one hand, was trying to do Trump's bidding, and on the other, he was influence peddling on his own behalf for all it was worth. And he would toggle back and forth and try to say, no, I'm really his lawyer. Oh, no, I'm actually not. So in the sort of silo of what Trump, running Trump's business there, he's got what Trump would be looking at if he weren't president: bribery, conspiracy, campaign finance violations. On the other side, all the influence peddling, he's looking at failure to register, false statements, obstruction, wire fraud. So it's two big pots. And talk to Rudy is the watchword, but the prosecutors in his old office haven't talked to him, which he should know well. That's a really bad sign. They're working their way up toward him, and they sent subpoenas far and wide on this laundry list of offenses, and he's in very, very hot water.
So with the two big pots, how does Giuliani's role affect the president in his impeachment defense? Because, you know, we here at CNN have reporting the prosecutors are a bit wary of the upcoming election and using that as a looming deadline. So how do they deal with that?
Yeah, they try in these kinds of instances to be impervious to it, but there's no way to really do it. But we've got enough. It's the actual guidelines try to keep their hands off the last 3 months. I don't think this will keep the Southern District of New York from going after him aggressively, and they already have his two sort of henchmen, Furman and Pronis, cooperating. So I think for now it doesn't change things if they actually indict him and there's a dynamic between the Trump charges and Giuliani charges, since Trump is already trying to throw him under the train. That then could really affect things on both sides of the Capitol.
Wasn't Rudy Giuliani doing, allegedly, exactly what he's accusing Joe Biden of doing, of pressuring foreigners for personal gain?
Well, yeah, but he's actually said now that they're just trying to come after me because I was trying to ferret out the Biden bribery. I think really much, much worse, because it's so much more broad, and there's this whole big half of it where he was really trying to feather his own nest by claiming influence and access with the president, which led to many different alleged criminal charges. Okay. So, yes, it's the pot calling the kettle black, or making the same kinds of charges and then some.
Yeah. Let's look to next week. December 4th, right, is ring-fenced in the calendar. It's the House Judiciary Committee hearing number one. They hold their first impeachment hearing. The White House is considering not sending any lawyer, any representative. Why would that be? Is that a big deal or not?
You know, it's a medium big deal. I think it's a big deal for the country in the sense that the White House really ought to see some responsibility for actually giving their version and letting the American people judge. But they're seeing it in sheer political partisan terms. And why wouldn't they come forward? Why wouldn't they at least have a witness there? I think they're thinking they don't want to validate the proceedings at all. They want to stand back and pick at the so-called, you know, fairness or due process issues and do anything but engage on the merits. And my best guess is they will stay away on the 4th, even though it's just an academic discussion, so that they can continue to say that the whole proceedings are a witch hunt.
Got it. Harry Littman, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Likewise. Thanks, Brooke.
Thank you. Same to you. Coming up next, could impeachment actually help Trump? Michael Bloomberg's campaign manager thinks so. We'll see if poll numbers bear that out. Also ahead, tens of thousands of people without power, hundreds of flights canceled. We'll get an update for you on two major storm systems on this Thanksgiving. As we were just discussing, next week brings the first House Judiciary Committee impeachment hearings, and this is the committee that will vote on whether to bring articles of impeachment against President Trump. If that is their decision, then it goes up for a full vote in the House. If that passes, the action then moves to hearings on the Senate side, where it is highly unlikely they would vote to convict the president and thus remove him. Now, Michael Bloomberg's campaign manager is warning that Democrats should actually pump the brakes.
There are about 31 congressional districts in this country that are swing districts. Mike Bloomberg spent an enormous amount of money and time and his own leadership to focus on 24 of those races last year, all Republican. We elected 18 Democrats, 15 of them are women. But if you're in one of those districts today and you're a moderate member of Congress, almost all of them would tell you today these impeachment hearings are threatening their reelection. Now, if you think about that, those are the districts, too, where we tilt the presidential election, which by definition means, hey, listen, these impeachment proceedings are making the president's reelection more likely, not less likely.
Let's go to CNN senior political analyst Ron Brownstein. He's with me. He's also senior editor over at The Atlantic. Ron, happy Thanksgiving, my friend.
Happy Thanksgiving, Brooke.
Do you buy Kevin Sheehy's analysis? Do you think Sheehy's right?
Well, first of all, I mean, that is quite an argument to start to walk into a Democratic primary with at a point where the vast majority of Democratic voters believe that what President Trump did justifies impeachment, regardless of the political consequences. I would say we obviously don't know exactly how this is going to play out, but both polling and history don't really offer a lot of support for the argument that this is like some guaranteed political winner for Republicans. First of all, you know, we've only had two impeachments in modern times. Richard Nixon resigned in 74 after the House Judiciary Committee voted articles of impeachment. And obviously, Bill Clinton faced impeachment in 1998. Each time the party that pursued the impeachment won the next election, the next presidential election. Mm-hmm. And they won it behind a candidate who presented themselves, in essence, as the antidote to the scandal that precipitated impeachment. I mean, Jimmy Carter in 76 ran on honesty and restoring a government as good as the people. And of course, George W. Bush in 2000 ran on restoring honor and decency to the Oval Office. So there's not a lot of evidence of seeing this backfire. And if you look at the polling right now, what impeachment is doing is more confirming than confounding or changing the lines of division on Trump. It's not really changing opinion much in terms of his job approval. But what it is doing, I think, is deepening the discontent among those who disapprove of him. I mean, over 90% of people who disapprove of Trump say that he does not believe in the rule of law and that he acted improperly in Ukraine. And that is a challenge for him at a moment when he has had faced majority disapproval for most of his presidency. And he ultimately needs some of those people to decide he's the lesser of two evils against the Democrat in 2020. So, no, I don't think, I mean, is it obviously a boon for Democrats? No. But is it a benefit for Trump? I don't think you can say that.
No, but I think your point about this sort of political pendulum swinging one, you know, one way, it's just eventually it ends up on the other side. What about big picture electorate? Because Democrats are making gains in the suburbs. But is that enough to beat Trump? Like, where is he most vulnerable?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, the biggest movement we've seen in the electorate since Trump's emergence in 2016 are the white-collar suburbs around the country moving toward Democrats. It was previewed in 2017 in Virginia when Democrats had a landslide in Northern Virginia, continued in 2018 when, as Kevin noted, Democrats won suburban seats all over the country, not only in traditionally Democratic metro areas like Minneapolis or Chicago or Denver, but also in places like Houston, Dallas, Atlanta, even Charleston that had not been Democratic. And again, in 2019, we saw this movement toward Democrats in the suburbs of Kentucky and Louisiana and Virginia again. And that is going to be a challenge for Trump in 2020. And there's no question about that. Is it enough? Certainly, it seems enough to win the popular vote, not guaranteed enough to win the Electoral College. And there, the reality is that the same forces that are moving these white-collar suburbs away from Trump while helping him with blue-collar, non-urban, exurban voters, et cetera, are also causing him problem with other groups, and particularly young people and minorities. So it's not just a question of the suburbs movement. The same things that are moving the suburbs are also threatening him with big turnout and big margins for Democrats among young people and minorities.
What about women, Ron?
Yeah. So, look, the gender gap is fascinating, right? I mean, the gender gap under Trump is very large, and it's true across racial groups. I mean, among African-American women, he's facing almost unanimous disapproval. Among Hispanic women, again, much more disapproval than among men. If you look at white women, there's a critical distinction. College-educated white women have become very negative on Trump. You see in the chart there, he has a disapproval rating of basically two-thirds. He faces the prospect of the largest vote against him for any Republican ever among college white women in 2020. But the key to the whole election may be the other group, which is the white women without a college degree. These are blue-collar white women. And by every data source we have, Brooke, Trump won them by at least 20 points in 2016. They were critical to his victories in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, the states that tipped the election. Look at where he is now. He's essentially an even split. That may not be enough for him in those states that decided the election. It leaves him on a very narrow ledge if, in fact, he can't do better than 50-50 among those working class white women who preferred him by big margins just 3 years ago.
I think the gender gap story is so, so fascinating. And I'm thinking for the people who dare talk politics over Turkey today, you know, they can talk about that.
They'll
they can also
see it.
The other thing is, you know, the conversation about, oh, my gosh, all the Democratic candidates and who's going to get the nomination. And, you know, I come back to the former vice president because, you know, despite Ron flubs, gaffes, you know, unfavorable moments in whatever debate, you know, this is a man who is still at the top of the heap. And I'm wondering from you, why do you think he's the guy?
Well, the one thing that's happened so far that's kept two things really have kept Biden afloat, despite what are pretty negative reactions from the Democratic electorate to his performance in the debate, understandably, where he's had a lot of, you know, kind of verbal gaffes and kind of stepped on his arguments at times. Two things. One, even no matter what else is going on, he holds a significant lead over any other Democrat when the party voters are asked who has the best chance of beating Trump. I mean, that has remained very consistent, particularly among older voters and particularly among non-white voters. And that really is the second key, which is that his advantage among African-American voters has not really diminished whatever else is going on in the polls in Iowa and New Hampshire. And Brooke, I think you can reduce the Democratic primary. You can identify what is the single most important question in the primary. And that is, if Biden underperforms, if he turns returns in subpar performances in Iowa and New Hampshire with their 90% plus white electorates, which certainly seem possible. Is that or is that not going to dislodge his African-American support in South Carolina? If it does, he will essentially, I think it'll be almost impossible for him to win the nomination. But if it doesn't, if he holds his black support in South Carolina and goes into the March states where the diversity of the Democratic Party is really represented, he can still tough out the nomination despite losing Iowa and New Hampshire, which is, by the way, something only George McGovern in 72 and Bill Clinton in 92 are the only Democratic nominees ever who didn't win either Iowa or New Hampshire.
That's some good trivia.
Biden could be a
trivia
third.
Over the turkey Biden. From Ron Brownstein.
A little trivia over the turkey.
Yeah. And we'll have answers to those questions in just a matter of months. Ron, thank you. You are the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Fiona Hill's testimony in the impeachment inquiry won a lot of praise from women because of how she stood up to men who doubted her. We will talk to Maeve Reston, who says that will be her legacy. All right, on this Thanksgiving, as you were there, you're breaking bread with your loved ones. You may be hoping that this month's impeachment hearings have faded from memory, but CNN's Maeve Reston is actually hoping one witness left an unforgettable legacy, and it's not for the reasons you may think. So, hi, Maeve Reston. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Brooke.
You wrote this great piece about Fiona Hill, the president's former top advisor on Russia and Europe. So let's revisit the standout moment you referenced in your piece where Hill detailed why she got irritated and angry with EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland. Watch this.
I was actually, to be honest, angry with him. And, I hate to say it, but often when women show anger, it's not fully appreciated. It's often, you know, pushed onto emotional issues, perhaps, or deflected onto other people. And what I was angry about was that he wasn't coordinating with us. Now, I actually realise, having listened to his deposition, that he was absolutely right, that he wasn't coordinating with us because we weren't doing the same thing that he was doing. So I was upset with him that he wasn't fully telling us about all of the meetings that he was having. And he said to me, but I'm briefing the president. I'm briefing Chief of Staff Mulvaney. I'm briefing Secretary Pompeo, and I've talked to Ambassador Bolton. He was being involved in a domestic political errand. And we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged. I did say to him, Ambassador Sondland, Gordon, I think this is all going to blow up, and here we are.
And here we are. So Maeve, it's when she says, when women show anger, it's not fully appreciated, it's often pushed onto emotional issues. Do you think a woman of her caliber confronting such a ubiquitous problem may have made a difference?
I do. I thought that moment was just so striking because it was this woman who has so much authority and credibility, and she took that moment in front of this dais of powerful men to say, you know what? You are so quick when women are angry to just push that aside, whether it's, you know, saying that it's hormones or they're emotional or they're, you know, having a panic attack. And maybe you should actually pay attention and listen, because what Fiona Hill was saying in that was her anger was about the fact that the U.S.-Ukraine policy had gone off the rails. And perhaps if more people had been listening to her earlier on, this history could have been very different for President Trump, Brooke.
So you think if perhaps someone hadn't just waved her off for being angry and had listened, that perhaps you and I wouldn't even be having this conversation, that a lot of what we've been discussing over the past few weeks may not have been a thing?
Well, totally possible. And I think this is such a legacy, you know, not only of the Me Too movement, which got people to pay attention to women in a different way, but also the 2016 campaign. Remember that famous moment when President Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman, and women around the country just rallied around that and embraced it. And we are seeing that over and over again in the 2020 campaign now, where Elizabeth Warren, when Joe Biden suggests that her rhetoric sounds angry, she's calling it out and she's saying, you know what, I am angry and you should pay attention. And I just think it's this moment, this cultural shift that we're seeing that's really exciting. And I do think that that's what Fiona Hill's legacy will be, that very keen observation that maybe made all of them think a little differently, Brooke.
I think it's totally exciting, and good on you for highlighting it. Maeve Reston, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, a look at the forecast as two major storms hit the U.S. this Thanksgiving. Plus, the Chinese government is furious with President Trump after he signed a bill supporting the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. Details on how that could impact ongoing trade talks. Well, thank goodness the winds cooperated. The show carried on here in New York City this morning. Balloons of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade were flying after all, though not quite as high as normal. That did not matter for the tens of thousands watching Snoopy kick off the annual holiday tradition. Those balloon handlers were keeping at least some of the giant balloons pretty close to the ground, making them more manageable in the high winds. So the winds cooperated, but that doesn't mean the weather woes have moved on in the Northeast or other parts of the country. CNN meteorologist Ivan Cabrera has an update for us. And so happy Thanksgiving, Ivan. And what's the big story today, weather-wise?
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you. I was just going to say, we just squeezed in the parade there with the balloons. The winds were 35, 40 miles an hour. You imagine, you cannot cancel the balloons. That's like canceling Santa Claus, which would never happen.
Never, ever, ever.
Ever. Unless you've been naughty, which that's a whole different story. But
we
can
keep going.
We have one storm. Goodbye, storm number one. Let's focus in on storm number two, because I think this one is going to be a mess for Sunday. It's already getting going. It's been snowing in New Mexico. It's been snowing in Arizona. It's been snowing in Southern California. The snow levels have plummeted, and this continues then to move up to the north and east. In that direction, we have winter storm warnings all over the place here. I think this will be a big deal. If you're traveling, the winter warnings, by the way, extend over 600 or 1,650 miles. Look at this storm getting going, cranked up your Friday. Now heading into Saturday, that's going to be a problem for the Midwest. And then, of course, along the busiest corridor here along I-95, we're going to be looking at a wintry mix for the big return home on a Sunday from Boston. It could be some accumulating snowfall, especially north and west of, say, 120, 495, and then showers and storms across the rest of the southeast. So just in time for the trek back home, it looks to be quite a mess. Would love to stay and chat, but the CNN diner line is getting out of hand, I think.
Go. I've already had my turkey here at
CNN.
Ivan, thank you.
You bet.
Other big news today. China is furious at President Trump for signing a human rights bill that supports protesters in Hong Kong. Activists gathered today in Hong Kong to thank President Trump. But China is threatening consequences for the U.S. amid already strained relations over trade. CNN's Will Ripley has more reaction from Hong Kong.
The competing images that we saw within hours of each other here in Hong Kong illustrates the deep division that exists in this city between the vast majority of citizens and the Hong Kong government and, of course, the Beijing government as well. You had thousands of people out in central Hong Kong waving American flags, thanking the United States and President Trump for passing the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which could potentially result in not only sanctions on Chinese and Hong Kong officials involved in human rights abuses, but it also crucially requires the State Department to review Hong Kong's highly coveted and hugely important special trade status. If that were to be revoked, it would be devastating for this territory's economy and for the mainland as well. And it would also hurt the United States, frankly. And so some of the people who are out there thanking the U.S. for passing this bill could someday actually be hurt by it. And yet that doesn't stop them from thanking the U.S. for supporting the pro-democracy movement. It's the second time in less than a week that the pro-democracy movement has scored a victory, because there was that landslide win in the district council elections where more than 90% of the votes and a record high turnout went to anti-establishment candidates. But despite all that, despite the overwhelming public opinion, you have Carrie Lam, the chief executive, and establishment lawmakers firmly in line with Beijing's view that the protesters are in fact rioters. And as proof of that, they offered up images from Poly U. They allowed the press to join police where they went in to take away the weapons that they say protesters were storing at that university, including 600 petrol bombs that were thrown at police, that used in these confrontations. The police claim it's the protesters that incite the violence. Protesters claim that police respond with disproportionate and excessive force against unarmed civilians. But Beijing asking the United States, why would they support a movement that engages in regular violence? And that's the big debate and the big divide here in Hong Kong. And for the moment, it really doesn't show any sign of bringing these two sides closer together. And on top of all of it, of course, you have these highly sensitive trade talks happening between Washington and Beijing. And now the big question is, will any deal be in jeopardy potentially because of these new developments and because President Trump decided to sign this bill into law? Will Ripley, CNN, Hong Kong.
Will, thank you. Coming up next, drama at America's Got Talent after Gabrielle Union was fired from her job as a judge. She's now speaking out about why she thinks it happened. When the reality show America's Got Talent returns in January, two of its popular judges will not be there, and that includes actress Gabrielle Union, who's gone very public about her exit. CNN Entertainment reporter Lisa France has more. First and foremost, happy Thanksgiving, my friend.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Great to have you on.
Thank you.
What happened here?
Well, Dwayne Wade says that he's tweeted that he's still waiting to find out exactly why his wife got fired. And soon after he sent a tweet in support of her, she tweeted to thank all of her fans for their support in the wake of what's happening. There was a report from Variety which said that she had gotten into some trouble because she spoke up following a racist joke on the show. She was asking the producers to take it to Human Resources, and also that she had gotten a lot of criticism from producers that her hairstyles on the show were, quote unquote, too black for the audience, and so she's not been invited back. Now, NBC has sent out a statement saying that they take diversity very seriously and that the rotation of judges and hosts on the show is part of what makes the show so successful. But lots of people are not buying that, including organizations like Time's Up, which have come out in support of Gabrielle Union, and also Grey's Anatomy star Ellen Pompeo, who's sent out some scathing tweets saying, you know, that NBC is the home that had issues with Matt Lauer and that they basically need to do better. And, you know, yeah, really, you know, so she says she supports Gabrielle Union's commitment to speaking up for injustice and talked about how courageous it was.
Wow. And so if she could have her, I mean, I guess she's gone. So new judges. But it's interesting how, you know, her husband has jumped in also in her defense. We'll watch to see where it goes. But thanks for explaining a bit of it. People
Absolutely.
Were wondering what
yes.
happened to her. Lisa, thank you.
Thank
Lisa
you.
France in Atlanta. And that's it for me. It's been a blast the last 2 hours here in New York City. Thanks for being with me on your holiday. I hope it's happy and healthy and safe with all your loved ones. Back-to-back episodes, by the way, coming up of our dear Anthony Bourdain. Parts Unknown starts right now.